Nuclear and climate change. No, it's not the solution. Nuclear is a bigger part of the problem and siphons off monies that should be going to genuine renewables like solar, wind, water, and geothermal. But that fact is ignored in the deluge of techniques used by the nuclear industry to justify and promote its toxic products. What to do? It takes a genuine expert on not only the science, but the political, social, and media issues surrounding this dangerous technology. So when he tells us...
The term small modular reactors, it is meant to also evoke the idea of it being physically small, you know, cute things that you can put in your neighborhood. But in reality, a small reactor, the small part of that, only refers to the power output.
So small modular nuclear reactors are not cute little Lego-like mini power plants, but rather low power generating weak reactors that come with all the same problems as their larger siblings: cost overruns, production delays, and creation of highly radioactive waste. Well, when you get that kind of information, and so much more, from an award-winning physicist and author, someone with unimpeachable credentials, you start to realize that the small in small modular nuclear reactor is just another hornswoggle of semantic manipulation brought to you courtesy that dangerous, deadly, awful seat that we all share.
Nuclear hot seat. What are those people thinking? Nuclear hot seat. What have those boys been drinking? Nuclear hot seat. The corium is sinking. Our time to act is shrinking, but our activists are linking. Nuclear hot seat. It's da bomb.
Welcome to Nuclear Hot Seat, the weekly international news magazine on all things nuclear from a different perspective. My name is Libby Halevi. I am the producer and host, as well as a survivor of the nuclear accident at Three Mile Island from just 1 mile away. So I know what can happen when those nuclear so-called experts get it wrong. This week, the conclusion of our two-part interview with physicist M. V. Ramana on his new book, Nuclear is Not the Solution: The Folly of Atomic Power in the Age of Climate Change. Part one ran 2 weeks ago on Nuclear Hot Seat number 693. Here, we're focusing on the problems of so-called small modular nuclear reactors and the connection they have with nuclear weapons. When it comes to nuclear reactors, smaller is definitely not better. We will also have nuclear news from around the world, numbnuts of the week for outstanding nuclear boneheadedness, a new monthly feature recounting our shared activist history, nuclear resistors, with Jack Cohen Joppa of the Nuclear Resistor Newsletter, and more honest nuclear information than anyone has time to consider in Western North Carolina or Florida after the recent hurricanes. All of it coming up in just a few moments. Today is Tuesday, October 15, 2024, and here is this week's nuclear news from a different perspective. Starting out in Japan this week, where the big international news is that an organization representing survivors of the 1945 atomic bomb attacks on Hiroshima and Nagasaki was named as the winner of this year's Nobel Peace Prize for its efforts to achieve a world free of nuclear weapons. Nihon Hidyanko, or the Japanese Conference of A and H Bomb Victims Organizations, has been campaigning since August 1956 for greater health care provisions for survivors of the attacks, known as hibakusha, or bomb-affected people, as well as a blanket ban on the development and use of nuclear weapons. The Norwegian Nobel Committee, making its announcement from its headquarters in Oslo, said the grassroots group had helped lead a global movement that has worked tirelessly to raise awareness about the catastrophic humanitarian consequences of using nuclear weapons. Over time, that has grown into a powerful international norm that stigmatizes the use of nuclear weapons as morally unacceptable. That norm has now become known as the nuclear taboo. When Tomoyuki Mimaki, the 82-year-old executive of the organization's Hiroshima branch and a survivor of the attack, was told about this award, he first said, "Unbelievable," and broke down crying. When asked by a reporter about the message he wished to share with people around the world, he said, "Please abolish nuclear weapons while we are still alive." That is the wish of 114,000 Hibakusha. People in Hiroshima and Nagasaki were quoted saying, "I hope that Hiroshima will be able to convey to the world its wish for eliminating nuclear weapons and war." A 24-year-old said that he hopes the winning of the Nobel Peace Prize will make Hiroshima more widely recognized as a symbol of peace. A 72-year-old woman praised the awarding of the event to Nihon Hidyanko because threats of using nuclear weapons are increasing now. And a 69-year-old in Fukushima Prefecture said, "It'd be best if nuclear weapons disappeared. I hope the prize will be an opportunity to abolish such weapons." But predictably, pro-nuclear forces have closed ranks to put together a very different vision of the future as it comes to nukes. And that's why, here's...
Nuclear Hot Seat! Nuclear Hot Seat! Nuclear Hot Seat! Nom Nuts of the Week!
Less than 24 hours after word got out about Nihon Hidyanko being awarded the Nobel Peace Prize on October 11, that Japanese so-called experts closed ranks to make nuclear more visible and seemingly important than the internationally awarded and acknowledged Atomic Bomb Survivors Organization. On October 12, just one day after the Nobel Peace Prize was awarded, Prime Minister Shigeru Ishiba reiterated his view that nuclear deterrence is needed in an increasingly fraught security environment. Quote, "I want to make sure that something like the Hiroshima or Nagasaki bombings never happens again." But then he pointed to the Russian invasion of Ukraine, a country which gave up its nuclear weapons after the dissolution of the Soviet Union, and stressed the importance of the U.S. nuclear umbrella for Japan's security. So, in essence, he said, we don't want nukes used, but we want nukes to be available to be used. No contradiction there at all. The same day that the Peace Prize was announced, the Japan Business Federation, or Kaidanren, proposed that the government, in its next basic energy policy, should, quote, "clearly spell out a policy to make the utmost use of power sources that contribute to the country's energy security and have, get this, high decarbonization effects, such as renewables and nuclear energy." The lobby went on to stress that securing a cheap and stable clean energy resources, such as nuclear power, how many false adjectives did you spot in that sentence? It went on to state that unless the restart of currently idled nuclear reactors is accelerated, existing nuclear plants are rebuilt, and new nuclear plants are constructed, the nation's power supply capacities will plummet in the 2040s. Take that, Nobel Peace Prize! And that's why, Japan Business Federation and Prime Minister Ishiba, you are this week's
Nuclear Hot Seat, Numbnuts of the Week!
One further point for your consideration is that the photos you see of Hiroshima after the bomb are completely sanitized of human deaths. You see wrecked buildings, but no bodies. We'll have a more honest photo of the aftermath of the bomb on our website, nuclearhotseat.com, under this episode, number 695. And at Fukushima Daiichi, on Tuesday, October 8th, a robot again began entering the Unit 2 reactor in an attempt to retrieve a tiny piece of the fuel that melted down in 2011. If successful, this robotic grabber will bring back about 3 grams to sample out of an estimated 880 tons of nuclear waste. This 3-gram sample has already been achieved once, but the first try at the job in August was thwarted by the fact that the robot is mounted on metal poles that should extend 22 meters, 72 feet, into the reactor's core, but operators managed to assemble the poles in the wrong order. So 2 weeks of reorganization was needed before trying again. Here in the U.S., a major piece appeared in the New York Times opinions section featuring a long piece by Bill Hennigan, who had hired last year to cover nuclear topics. The title of the piece is America is Updating Its Nuclear Weapons. The price is $1.7 trillion. After 6 months of research to 26 separate nuclear sites in the country, it has been determined by Henninger and the Times that this little update will include 12 new nuclear submarines, 5 new uranium processing facilities, 400 missiles in silos in western states that will be replaced, 80 plutonium pits per year for 15 years, and the U.S. government is considering increasing the number of nuclear weapons even more after the New START treaty with Russia expires in February 2026. The printout of this extensive article runs more than 12 pages and is behind a paywall, but we will link to an accessible version of it on our website, nuclearhotseat.com, under this episode, number 695. In Wyoming, lawmakers have advanced a measure that opens the state to possible nuclear fuel waste storage. Despite public testimony against the measure, the legislative committee says it will introduce a bill before the full legislature in January. If passed, it will provide the opportunity to discuss changing Wyoming's statutes to enable temporary, put that word in quotes, storage of high-level radioactive fuel waste from nuclear power plants. There remains on the state books a statute prohibiting the commercial high-level radioactive waste facility unless the federal government establishes a permanent repository. That would not be Yucca Mountain, because Yucca Mountain in Nevada is a legal fiction that will never be made into a long-term repository for radioactive waste. This fiction is kept alive so that other locations, including West Texas, southeastern New Mexico, and now Wyoming, can be considered quote-unquote interim and be allowed to move forward. Jill Morrison, who lobbied against similar measures in the past, noted that the draft bill requires only 30 days' notice to the public before commencement of construction for such a facility. And she said, dealing with high-level radioactive waste is not a simple matter, and it's been rejected by the state of Wyoming, by the public, 3 times. I think the people of the state should get an opportunity to weigh in on something like this. And we'll have links up on the website to 2 articles of interest. The first, the radioactive legacy of the Hanford Nuclear Reservation will live on, even as plans for cleanup evolve. Well, that's an optimistic headline for a very pessimistic situation. And a new article in Counterpunch by the esteemed activist Harvey Wasserman, Nuke Powers Renaissance 4.0, has already melted. Access both articles through links on our website, nuclearhotseat.com. This episode is number 695. Across the pond to the UK, where French energy company EDF is reportedly in talks with investors to raise up to £4 billion to finish the delayed Hinkley Point C project in Somerset, meant to be Britain's first new nuclear reactors in a generation. And if they keep going like this, it will be 2 generations. The utilities company, owned by the French state, has approached investors to help cover the ballooning costs of constructing the nuclear plant, which is understood to have reached almost £50 billion, due in part to supply chain issues and struggles securing skilled engineers after Brexit. This according to Bloomberg. Note that nuclear companies never blame their own faulty planning and lack of foresight when it comes to prices ballooning and schedules that are way behind schedule. According to current estimations, Hinkley Point C is due to begin generating electricity by 2030, according to EDF, which puts it 5 years later than first planned and 12 years after construction began. And Beyond Nuclear International has sent out a very disturbing article about nuclear weapons and children. It points out that in a nuclear attack, children would be more likely than adults to die from burn injuries, as their skin is thinner and more delicate and burns deeper, to die from blast injuries, given the relative frailty of their smaller bodies, to die from acute radiation sickness, be unable to free themselves from collapsed and burning buildings, or take other steps in the aftermath that would increase their chances of survival, would be more likely to suffer from leukemia, solid cancers, strokes, heart attacks, and other illnesses years later as a result of the delayed effects of radiation damage to their cells, and suffer psychological trauma leading to mental disorders and suicide. There's much more to this no nukes argument, and we'll link to it on our website, nuclearhotseat.com, episode number 695. We'll have this week's featured interview in just a moment, but first, what bothers you most about nuclear? The Armageddon-level threat of weapons? Forever quantities of cancer-causing, highly radioactive waste with no place to store it? Contamination of the land, water, food? The obscene amounts of money nuclear siphons away from genuine renewable energy and human services? You can do nothing about nuclear threats without knowing the truth about what this technology is and does to all of us. And communicating that truth is what Nuclear Hot Seat is about. Every week, Nuclear Hot Seat provides you with the information you need to understand what's happening in the nuclear industry. They don't fund us, so we're not influenced by the millions of dollars they spend on their unending propaganda media machine. We cover what you face in terms of the threats to health, welfare, and safety, and what you, what we, what any of us can do about it. But we can't do this work without your help. Nuclear Hot Seat runs exclusively on donations and can't survive without you. So if you listen to this show and are grateful for the information you receive, now is the time to help us out. Be it a one-time donation of any amount or a monthly recurring donation, even $5, the equivalent of a cup of coffee and a tip here in the U.S., will help us by supporting the services required to keep this program running. Nuclear Hot Seat is a 501c3 nonprofit organization, which means that your donation is tax deductible. And we make it easy. Go to nuclearhotseat.com, click on the red donate button, or send directly via Zelle to info@nuclearhotseat.com. No amount is too small, no amount is too large. So don't wait. Nuclearhotseat.com to donate now. And whatever you can do to help, I'm deeply grateful that you're listening and that you care. Now, here's this week's featured interview. 2 weeks ago, for Nuclear Hot Seat 693, we interviewed physicist M. V. Ramana on his just-published book, Nuclear is Not the Solution, The Folly of Atomic Power in the Age of Climate Change. In it, this much-lauded physicist has laid out the case against nuclear in clear, concise, easy-to-understand writing. He proved such a compelling guest, our interview ran over. So instead of eliminating anything important, we're running the full interview in two parts. Just a few of Ramana's credentials include Professor and Simmons Chair in Disarmament, Global and Human Security at the University of British Columbia, a member of the International Panel on Fissile Materials, the Canadian Pugwash Group, the International Nuclear Risk Assessment Group, and he may be familiar to Nuclear Hot Seat listeners as a member of the team that produces the annual World Nuclear Industry Status Report. I spoke with Ramana on Friday, September 27, 2024. There's been a growing push for what the industry refers to as SMRs, small modular reactors, which very neatly takes out the word nuclear. So I refer to them as SMNRs, or small modular nuclear reactors. And governments around the world are jumping on that bandwagon, throwing ever greater amounts of money at companies that claim to be able to make these modular, cute, I call them like Legos, that get stuck together nuclear reactors. And there's a lot that's wrong with them. First, what is the difference between the older generation of nuclear reactors, the large ones that we have that are in operation, and these proposed new ones?
The term small modular reactors, it is meant to also evoke the idea of it being physically small, you know, cute things that you can put in your neighborhood. But in reality, a small reactor, the small part of that only refers to the power output. A small modular nuclear reactor is defined as one whose power output is less than 300 megawatts. That's the International Atomic Energy Agency's definition. So the 300 megawatts is roughly about a third of the size of the typical reactor we construct today. We usually say it's about 1,000 megawatts. The reactors that were built in Vogtle are designed to generate 1,100 megawatts each. So that gives you a sense of scale. But the physical size of the reactor depends sensitively on what kind of nuclear reactor it is. Different designs, some designs can be smaller and some could be larger, and there's no connection between that. The other term, modular, is supposed to evoke exactly the point that exactly the way you put it, as Lego blocks that come together. In this case, what they say is these are factory-built objects. So let me start with that. So modular construction is something we do all the time, right? If you think about a neighboring apartment complex that is being built or an office building that's built, nobody brings bricks and wood and carpenters to the site to actually brick and make all the windows and the doors there. Everything is shipped to the place from factories, and all that is being done there is mostly assembly of these different components. It's exactly that process that is sought to be used in making small modular reactors. But that process was also used to make the AP1000 reactors that were constructed in Georgia. Westinghouse, at the turn of the century, when they were promoting not just the AP1000, but even the precursor to that, the AP600 design, which was in the 1990s, Westinghouse's attempt to come up with a new reactor design. They would say, because of this modular construction process that we have, and the design is modularly, is meant to be constructed in a modular fashion, we will be able to cut the time of construction. And it's going to be really fast. And for a long time now, it's no longer there on their website, but they used to have a little animated video which would show different parts of the reactor coming together. So it'll be month one, month two, month three, and it'll go on till 36 months. That used to be their time they would promise, and the thing would come together. On screen, it looks absolutely great. But unfortunately, what works on the screen doesn't work in the real world. So that's the modular. We have no reason to think that small modular reactors are going to be any different. They are also going to be delayed. They are also going to have problems that, if not happening in the site of construction, will happen in the factory, as happened in the case of AP1000s. But I want to come back to the small part, which I think is even more interesting. Around the world, countries that started to build nuclear power plants in the 1950s and 60s and so on started by building small reactors. The first reactors that were built in the United States and Canada and India, all of them would fit the definition of small. They are all low-powered reactors. And then over a period of time, the nuclear industry started increasing the power levels. Why did they do that? Because they were trying to take advantage of what are called economies of scale. When you build a reactor that generates five times as much electricity, the company that owns it will sell five times as much electricity, will get five times as much revenue for it. But they don't have to spend five times as much money to build a reactor because, let's say, a 1500 megawatt reactor does not need five times as much concrete as a 300 megawatt reactor. It doesn't need five times as many workers as a 300 megawatt reactor. So you save on costs when you go to larger sizes. And that's exactly why the nuclear industry started building bigger and bigger reactors. Despite all those economies of scale, nuclear power is the most expensive way to generate electricity today. And so this is the real conundrum that nobody wants to order nuclear plants because they are so expensive and you have to do all this political machination before you can get an order for a nuclear plant. So they come up with this new story saying, oh, we have these new designs, the so-called small modular reactors. Those are going to be somehow much faster, much cheaper, and so on and so forth. But if you look under the bonnet, as it were, there is no reason to expect that small modular reactors will solve any of the problems. There are, broadly speaking, four kinds of problems the nuclear industry itself sees for itself. In 2003, the Massachusetts Institute of Technology put out a report called The Future of Nuclear Power. This was kind of the height of the early stages of what is called the nuclear renaissance at that point. And they mentioned that there were four problems we have. The cost problem, the fact that there's a risk of accidents, that it produces nuclear waste, radioactive waste that we don't know how to deal with, and that there's a linkage with nuclear weapons proliferation. Now, of these four problems, three of the problems, the waste, the risk of accidents, and the linkage with nuclear weapons, are inherent to all nuclear reactors, whether they are small or large. Even a small modular reactor will produce enough plutonium to, let's say, make about 10 bombs every year. A small reactor, which is only generating, let's say, 200 megawatts. So that's really small in terms of how much electricity it supplies to a country, but it is quite a large amount of plutonium for use in nuclear weapons. So that's one of the challenges with this. And of course, all nuclear reactors have to produce radioactive waste because that's an inherent part of the nuclear fission process, right, which is how you produce the heat. And I want to remind the listeners that a nuclear reactor ultimately is just a very complicated way to boil water using a hazardous process of nuclear fission. And so all of these attributes are related to that. And the reason why nuclear power plants are so expensive is because you're trying very hard to make sure that this radioactive material never exits into the biosphere, that there's no accident that allows this material to come out of the reactor and be spread out. But nevertheless, it's impossible to design a nuclear reactor with no possibility of an accident. The probability of an accident will always be greater than zero. And despite what the nuclear industry says, and I've sort of explained this more in my book, there is no way to reliably calculate what the risk of an accident is, what the probability of an accident is. And all of these methods that they use have uncertainties. I've said a lot of things, but I just want to recap what I'm saying. All nuclear power plants have these three fundamental problems having to do with the physics of the reactor, the risk of accidents, the production of radioactive waste, and the linkage with nuclear weapons. And because of these things, the fourth problem that they face, the high cost of construction, is a result of all of these problems. Now, when you go to small reactors, how does the picture change? The most important element, I think, is thinking about the cost of it. Because of what I mentioned earlier about economies of scale, a small nuclear reactor will always be more expensive than a large nuclear reactor per unit of capacity, either power capacity or energy production. That's ultimately the most important metric. It's not the total cost. For the industry, it may be the total cost, because one of the lessons they learned from all of the rounds of nuclear reactors that were constructed in the post-nuclear renaissance era, whether it's Vogel or whether it's Flamanville in France or Olkiluoto in Finland or the ongoing Hinkley Point project in the UK, is that the total absolute cost of these reactor projects is enormous. $35 billion, $40 billion. These are not amounts that most utilities actually have access to. So this is where the nuclear industry is coming in and saying, oh, you can build a small modular reactor because that will only cost you $3 billion or $5 billion. And that money you can probably find somewhere or the other. But the problem is that the $3 billion will fetch you far less electricity than the larger reactor project, right? So on a per unit basis, it's actually going to be more expensive.
That's a really thorough explanation of the economics behind. So let's get to the physical reality or lack thereof of these so-called small modular nuclear reactors. And that is, do any currently exist? Are any in operation? Are there prototypes? And are there any approved designs for building them?
Yes and no. There are two small modular reactor projects operating in Russia and in China. There are two floating power plants that Russia has operated since 2020, I think, for the last few years. Then there are two reactors, high-temperature gas-cooled reactors, that China bought online a couple of years ago. What we can say about both of those projects is, one, they also demonstrated all of the problems we've seen with nuclear projects. They were delayed. They were more expensive than they were initially costed at. And the second thing we have learned from them is that they are not operating very well. The Russian reactors, what we call the capacity factor, the efficiency with which the reactor is producing electricity, is around 30% in every year. Whereas the US nuclear reactors, when they are operating, for example, will operate around 90% capacity factor. So small modular reactors that are operating don't seem to be operating very well. The Chinese case is even more interesting in that within a year of the reactor being brought into commercial operation, the power output had to be reduced by 25%. It came down from 200 megawatt to 150 megawatt. We have no idea why, because China is not very transparent with all of its data. And secondly, that reactor, even at the lower power level in 2023, produced only enough power that it could have produced in 1 month of operation during the year. So it's almost as though for 11 months of the year it was not operating. And then in the 12th month, suddenly it produced a certain amount of power. But of course, in reality, that's not how it would have probably operated. It was probably operating at a lower power level and going, working and not working. And the integrated total amounts to 1 month of power output.
Other than China and Russia, speaking of the Western world, there's this big push by the US, by the UK, throughout the world to install small modular nuclear reactors. And I think that's what I'm looking for. Is there a standard design? Are there any prototypes? Do we know the technology will work? Does the technology exist anywhere except on some elaborate PowerPoints?
That's a great question. At one level, we can expect the technology to work in the sense that it's probably possible to build one of these nuclear reactors and have it produce electricity. But the question we should be asking is, will it be built on time? Will it be built on budget? Will it have a risk of accident? What are the risks of accidents associated? Those are the questions we should be asking. As I mentioned earlier, I think the examples of Russia and China are instructive in that they have tried to build these projects and they demonstrate all of the problems we have seen with nuclear power plants, right? And so there's no reason to expect the United States power plants, SMRs, will be any different. And I'll also mention one other project, which is in the West, but not in the North. It's in Argentina. Argentina has been building a small modular reactor called CARIM since 2014. And at that time, they were predicting when the construction started that the reactor will be operating by late 2017 or early 2018, right? Of course.
The clocks run differently in the nuke world.
Exactly, right? So it's now 2024. Now they say 2028, but nobody really believes that's going to happen there. Coming to the United States, the only design that has been licensed by the Nuclear Regulatory Commission is NuScale's 50 megawatt design. NuScale submitted that design. It was approved with some very important caveats. There were issues that had to be addressed, and the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, in my opinion, should not have given them the approval without ensuring that the issues they identified had been resolved by NuScale. But I think they were under political pressure to show that they can operate fast, and so they gave the approval. What is interesting is that between the time NuScale submitted that design for approval and the approval came, NuScale had changed its mind. It had increased the size of the output of the reactor from 50 megawatts to first to 60 megawatts and then to 77 megawatts. If you go to the NuScale website, you won't even see the 50 megawatt design advertised there anymore. Now, NuScale has gone back to NRC and said, okay, now we have a 7 megawatt design. Now, you already approved our 50 megawatt design. Why don't you approve this one as well? And again, NRC has asked them a bunch of questions. In the meanwhile, NuScale's first sort of flagship project, the one that was proposed for UAMPS, that project was canceled last November because the cost estimate had gone up to $9.3 billion. And that I think is very important because it's not just the fact that the cost was $9.3 billion, much higher than the $3, $4 billion they were initially talking about. But also, if you think about how much power you would have got for that $9.3 billion, it perfectly illustrates the lack of economies of scale that I mentioned earlier. So for $9.3 billion, remember, this is the cost before the construction started, before any of the usual type of cost overruns happened, right? This is a cost estimate. $9.3 billion, 460 megawatts means that the per megawatt or per kilowatt cost is more than the cost of Vogtle. And this is all before all of the cost overruns. So actually the thing to compare with is actually the cost of Vogtle when construction started. At that time, it was supposed to be $14 billion for around 2,200 megawatts. And if you do math, you will find that this is about 250% of that cost estimate. So NuScale is already uneconomical without even the construction starting, right? So I don't think we really need many, many more experiments of this sort. But of course, you know, all of these countries, all of these very powerful institutions, including the Department of Energy in the US, and in Canada, we have our share of these nuclear promoters, are sending money to these people. In the US, it's in the hundreds of millions of dollars. In Canada, it's in the tens of millions of dollars, hoping to be able to get one of these projects going. And so every now and then you see, you know, $100 million here, you know, $200 million there. And the latest, I think, is DOE wants to give $800 million, if I remember right, for, they don't say NuScale, but everything, you know, about the description suggests that it is going to be NuScale. And this is on top of something like $560 million they have already funded NuScale. So they're sort of in this position of having spent some money and they want to throw more good money after bad. And that's exactly, I think, that's the unfortunate situation we are in. I'll also say one last thing about SMRs. The government investments in these small modular reactors projects seem to be very large amounts. But on the scale of what is required to actually move one of these reactor designs from conception to the point where it is being licensed by NRC and ready for construction is of the order of $2 billion. NuScale has said it has spent already $1.8 billion and it is not yet ready for construction. So that, I think, is something to remember. So, you know, when X Energy or any of these other companies say they've got $35 million or $75 million from DOE, that's really a drop in the bucket.
It sounds like small modular nuclear reactors are really the equivalent of a naked emperor, that there's something there and people are just refusing to see how bad they are. Be it a small reactor or a large one, given that once a nuclear reactor starts up and begins producing radioactive waste, highly radioactive waste, we are stuck with supporting the nuclear industry forever. They propose a technology that creates the problem, they maintain the problem, and then even after the reactors stop operating, we're stuck with the problem that goes into infinity because the stuff is radioactive for a minimum of a quarter of a million years. In your opinion and in your understanding of the science, is there a way out of this?
There's no good way out. We are now fated to deal with all of this radioactive waste all over the world in many, many different countries. And there is no good way of dealing with it. The only answer the nuclear industry has come up with is to bury it in a deep hole somewhere, right? Dig a deep hole, bury it, and leave it there, right? They don't, of course, call it a deep hole. They would call it a deep geological repository, but that's just a fancy term for a hole there. There is no guarantee that this material will not get out of there. It is not possible for them to give us a guarantee. They can do all these elaborate calculations to show that the probability is low and the radiation dose is going to be only so small and so on and so forth. But there are lots of assumptions involved in those calculations, including, for example, we have no idea how people in, let's say, the 31st century are going to be behaving. What are they going to be mining for? How are they going to be conducting their business, et cetera, et cetera. We don't really know any of these things. You can make some assumptions, but not. You know, the other strange thing, of course, with these repositories is that we have no way of even communicating to those people that there is something bad buried here. Given all of these problems, I don't think we actually have any satisfactory solution. We can choose between a bunch of bad solutions, but I think all of that, for at least on the side of us who are protesting or who are critical of the nuclear industry, I think that's secondary to actually the more important point, which is before we come to a solution, before we can agree on a solution, we have to agree to stop producing this material. That is very clear. I think it was Will Rogers who was supposed to have said, when you find yourself in a hole, the first thing you have to do is to stop digging. That's the most important thing. Unfortunately for us, the nuclear industry sees nuclear waste as a public relations problem. And so they really would like to set up a repository and they kind of appeal to all of our better senses. They will say, oh, you know, it's our responsibility to deal with this safely. We don't want to pass on this burden to our children and grandchildren. So won't you agree to do a repository. And of course, they will go to one of these disempowered poor communities that I mentioned and say, hey, you know, how would you like a $1 billion project in your neighborhood? You know, think of all the jobs it's going to create. It's a high-tech opportunity. You're going to make history by being the first place in this country to be able to deal with this. How about it? It's all a public relations game, essentially. But the moment one of these things get sanctioned and things start up, buried underground, they will turn around and say, we have solved the problem. Let's get on with the business of building more nuclear reactors. And I think that that dynamic means that we are not going to be the ones who should be telling them, here's what you should be doing with the solution, in my opinion. I think what we should be doing is to say, let's first talk about production before we talk about how you're going to dispose it.
One point we haven't yet talked about is the connection between nuclear power and nuclear weapons. Most people are unaware that nuclear weapons and nuclear reactors are connected with the other. They're intrinsically joined at the hip with each other. What is that about, and how would you explain that to people so they can understand and get that they're not two separate stories and two separate issues? They're the same thing.
Yeah, the relationship between nuclear weapons and nuclear energy, the technologies to generate nuclear weapons, nuclear energy, and the technology to make nuclear weapons material are inextricably linked. Five types of linkages that I talk about in the book. The first is history. We know that the first nuclear reactors were constructed to make plutonium to make nuclear weapons that were dropped on Hiroshima, on Nagasaki, and also the one that was tested even before that in New Mexico on July 16, 1945. So the first nuclear reactors were made for that. In many countries, this was the case. The first nuclear reactors in many of the countries that have nuclear weapons were built for making material for nuclear weapons. Historically, that's how the technology even spread to many, many of these countries, because they tried to get the technology to make nuclear weapons, and then they kind of spun off a nuclear energy industry from that technology. The second linkage, which I think is also apparent, is the geographical overlap. So there are roughly around 30-odd countries around the world that have nuclear power plants. The vast majority of these nuclear power plants are in countries that have nuclear weapons. The United States, China, France, the UK, Russia, India, Pakistan, all of these have nuclear weapons and nuclear power plants. And if you include countries like Canada, where I live, and you know many of the Western European countries, which are linked to nuclear weapon states like the United States, to military alliances, then the overlap is even more overwhelming. That's, I think, a second kind of overlap. Then there's the technology that I kind of mentioned, which is that the two fundamental ways in which you can make nuclear weapons, materials for nuclear weapons, is to enrich uranium into what's called highly enriched uranium, or actually weapons-grade uranium, and plutonium. The bomb that was dropped on Hiroshima was based on weapons-grade uranium. What was dropped on Nagasaki was based on plutonium. Now, all nuclear power plants operating in the United States use low-enriched uranium, that is uranium in which the uranium-235 component has been increased from what is found in nature, which is about 0.7%, to something like 3 to 5%. The process by which you produce that low-enriched uranium, you can use exactly the same process to keep concentrating the uranium-235 to make it weapons-grade uranium. And this is actually the source of the concern about Iran. Iran claims that it has a peaceful nuclear program, and it is trying to enrich uranium because it wants to build nuclear reactors for power and for research. But everybody else says, well, you know, that is also going to allow you to make material for weapons, and we don't trust you to not do that. So this is an inherent challenge. And Iran, because of the relations with the United States, is seen as suspect. But if it's a country that is friendly with the United States will say, oh, that's okay, they're not going to do this. So it becomes a matter of trust. But the other material, plutonium, is something that's produced in all nuclear reactors. As long as they are fueled by uranium, there will be plutonium in the cores of these reactors, and they can be extracted through the chemical process called reprocessing. In both cases, whether it's uranium enrichment or reprocessing and plutonium, ultimately it becomes a matter of intent of these countries rather than capacity. Once a country has these nuclear program, they will have some of the materials that is required to make nuclear weapons. There are two other connections I want to mention, which is the connection between personnel. The people who are trained to build and operate nuclear power plants also inadvertently receive training that can be used to make materials for nuclear weapons. The perfect illustration of this was the country of Pakistan. When Pakistan first embarked on the idea that it wanted to have a nuclear program, people looked at what is the state of educational resources in Pakistan, and they concluded that Pakistan just didn't have the necessary trained people. What allowed Pakistan to eventually set up a nuclear program, which then developed nuclear weapons, was the Atoms for Peace program that was started by President Eisenhower in 1953. And Pakistani scientists and engineers came over to the United States, got trained, went back, and they set up the program. The same thing happened in the case of Iran. In the 1970s, the Shah of Iran decided that he was going to build nuclear power plants. He sent a bunch of people, including to MIT. And in fact, MIT got a whole bunch of money to train these people specially. And some of them are the ones who are heading the Iranian nuclear program today. So that's the fourth thing. The fifth is institutional. In many countries, it's the same institution that oversees nuclear weapons and promotes nuclear energy. In the United States, that's the Department of Energy. In India, it is the Department of Atomic Energy. So there is an institutional interest. And Indian case, I think, is particularly interesting because the Department of Atomic Energy was initially set up only to do atomic energy for peaceful purposes. Eventually, they branched off into making nuclear weapons. And they realized there was a lot of political power to be obtained by doing that. And so they have no interest in giving up their nuclear weapons pursuits because it is providing them with huge budgets and political clout. So there are all these connections. I think there are two other things I do want to mention here, because this is all sort of evident to people who go and study this business. The reason why many people don't see the connection is because the nuclear industry actively promotes the idea that there is a difference between nuclear power plants and nuclear weapons. They will always tell you, oh, a nuclear power plant is not going to explode like a nuclear bomb. You're just completely misinformed. Of course, nobody is saying that a nuclear reactor is what is going to explode, though it can happen. That's a separate point. But what we are saying is there are strong connections, and they want to deny that, except when they are in financial trouble. When they are in financial trouble, they turn around and they say, look, our nuclear power industry is suffering, is having financial troubles, and you, the government, ought to come and subsidize us. Why? Because we are actually helping you with all of your defense programs. So this is what happened in, let's say, 2017. When the Trump administration came to power, the nuclear industry knew that the climate change argument was not going to work. So they immediately turned and they said, we are going to campaign on basically two points. One is the linkage with the weapons industry, with the Defense Department, especially because a lot of people who work in nuclear power plants are people who have been trained in the nuclear Navy to operate nuclear submarines. And then once they retire from the Navy, they go on to working in nuclear power plants. So this is a kind of a two-way door, as it were. And then the other argument, of course, they used to make was, we're going to create jobs, which is another absurd argument. We don't want to talk about it, but in the Trump administration, of course, that can sell because Trump was selling the idea of jobs everywhere. This is actually part of a trend in the UK too. When the nuclear industry was in trouble, the nuclear energy industry, they appealed to the government to bail them out, to support them in various ways because they would contribute to the Trident nuclear submarine in the UK. So this is a pattern where they can use connection when they want it, and they want to hide the connection when they don't want it.
Ramana, it's good to know that some people have their eye on the ball and are able to translate it in such a way that we can understand it. So for your expertise, for your amazingly wonderful book, Nuclear is Not the Solution, The Folly of Atomic Power in the Age of Climate Change, that's the subtitle, I want to thank you for being my guest this week on Nuclear Hot Seat.
Libby, thank you so much for inviting me, for talking to me. And I deeply, deeply admire all of the work you've been doing ever since Fukushima. I've been listening to your show regularly, and I've learned a ton from that.
Physicist and author M.V. Ramana. We'll have a link up on our website to his book, Nuclear is Not the Solution, The Folly of Atomic Power in the Age of Climate Change, under this episode, number 695. We'll also have a handy link available to the first part of this interview from Nuclear Hot Seat, number 693.
Activist, shout out.
We have a new monthly feature that's starting this week, and Nuclear Hot Seat is proud to present the Nuclear Resistors. Here's Jack Joppa Cohen of the Nuclear Resistor newsletter with this story from the history of activism in opposition to nuclear.
Nuclear resistors are the people who face arrest and jail to say no to nukes. Since 1980, my wife Felice and I have been reporting on their arrests, trials, and time behind bars through the Nuclear Resistor newsletter, and now also online at nuclearresistor.org. We've chronicled over 50,000 such arrests and supported hundreds of people in jail and prison for all manner of creative, determined, risky, and altogether inspiring nonviolent actions against the nuclear threat. I'm excited to be sharing some of these stories with you on Nuclear Hot Seat. So who were the first nuclear resistors? Back at the birth of the atomic bomb in 1945, before many of us were born, one of them was a Danish immigrant in his 30s named Bent Andresen. During the Great Depression, Bent attended Columbia University, joined the Socialist Party and the War Resisters League, got married, and worked as a union organizer while promoting the cooperative movement. So it was not surprising that when the United States entered the Second World War, Bent was among the more than 40,000 men who registered as conscientious objectors. There were so many objectors that the government set up a new program. The Civilian Public Service, CPS, was an option to do work of national importance under civilian direction that allowed war refusers to serve their country without betraying their principles. Bent Andresen signed up. At a civilian public service camp in Michigan, he served his country by living in a refrigerated room for 3 months with several other conscientious objectors for a study of high-protein diets in cold weather conditions. And then he was sent west to the CPS camp in Minersville, California. Soon after he arrived, on August 6, 1945, the United States dropped the A-bomb on Hiroshima. Bent Andresen was appalled, and in protest, he went AWOL, absent without leave, and he walked out of the camp. Years later, for a CPS history project, he wrote of what he did next. "I drafted and mimeographed 5,000 copies of my protest statement and took off to hitchhike to New York City, where my wife was living. I gave out hundreds of copies on street corners in cities I passed through, single copies to all those who gave me rides. Only once was I ejected, and only once did the police apprehend me on the assumption that I was wanted by the FBI. In New York City, I told the DA where I was staying and offered to come in when he wanted to see me. Eventually, he told me to report to Sacramento, California for trial. When I refused to provide my own transportation, I was locked up until two deputies were assigned to transport me. At night, they put me in leg irons and handcuffs in the railroad sleeper. When we got to San Francisco City Jail, I stopped eating. When the authorities in Sacramento County Jail found I wasn't eating, they took me to court. The judge ordered me to county hospital for forced feeding and psychiatric exam. Subsequently, the judge sentenced me to 2 years. Before long, I was transported by marshals to the Medical Center for Federal Prisoners at Springfield, Missouri. I was on total fast, no food or water willingly, for 8 months. When I had served 7 months at Springfield, the deputy warden told me they were going to let me go, and I was put on a train for New York City. So, Bent Andresen was again together with his wife. They eventually settled in Bucks County, Pennsylvania, where Bent remained an activist for a peaceful nuclear-free world until his death in 1991 at age 83. This has been Jack Cohen-Joppa for Nuclear Hot Seat with this story from the Nuclear Resistor Archives to inspire your activism today.
I'm happy to tell you that once a month, we will have another story from our shared activist history from Jack Joppa Cohen of the Nuclear Resistor. By the way, it's a great publication to get. You can sign up for their newsletter and research stories from past issues by going to nuclearresistor.org. And of course, there will be a link up on the website, nuclearhotseat.com, under this episode, number 695. In other activist shout-outs, congratulations to the film San Onofre Syndrome. It's now available on Amazon Prime, and it was recently awarded with the Best Actuality Subject Award at the 13th Global Nonviolent Film Festival. So if you want to catch up with this really wonderfully well-done film, search it out on Amazon Prime. And if you are in New York, you are cordially invited to the Global Peace Flag exhibit at the United Nations headquarters, which will be on display until November 15, 2024. This exhibit brings together flags from 193 countries, symbolizing a global commitment to peace, unity, and sustainability, all of it created using repurposed fashion waste. This unique project aims to inspire collective action and highlight the importance of global cooperation in addressing the challenges of our times. And of course, that includes nukes. This has been Nuclear Hot Seat for Tuesday, October 15, 2024. If you want to make certain you never miss another episode of Nuclear Hot Seat, we make it easy because you can get it delivered via email every week. Sign up for it at nuclearhotseat.com by filling out the yellow box, first name, email address. We don't bug you. We just send you one email a week, which contains a link to that week's show and a brief rundown of some of the material that's in it. You also have the option of going to your favorite podcast service and signing up for Nuclear Hot Seat there, because we are everywhere. And we don't want you to miss any episodes, because this story just keeps moving. Now, if you have a story lead, a hot tip, or a suggestion of someone to interview, send an email to info@nuclearhotseat.com. And remember, really important, if you can go to Nuclear Hot Seat and donate, we really need your help. Nothing is too small. Nothing is too big. It all helps, and we really appreciate and need your support. This episode of Nuclear Hot Seat is copyright 2024, Libby Halevi and Nuclear Hot Seat and Hardestry Communications. All rights reserved, but fair use allowed, as long as you cite the program, website, names of guests whose comments you used, and me. For now, this is Libby Halevi of Nuclear Hot Seat, reminding you that as Tomoyuki Mimaki, the 82-year-old co-chair of the Nobel Peace Prize-winning Nihon Hideyanko, said, please abolish nuclear weapons while we are still alive. There you have it. You have just had your weekly nuclear wake-up call. So whatever you do, do not go back to sleep, because we are all in the Nuclear Hot Seat.
Nuclear Hot Seat. What are those people thinking? Nuclear Hot Seat. What have those boys been drinking? Nuclear Hot Seat. The corium is sinking. Our time to act is shrinking, but our activists are linking. Nuclear Hot Seat. It's da bomb.